now, live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Monday on this 12th day of September, 2016. I hope you all had a blessed weekend. I hope that many of you had the opportunity to minister to those who still, after 15 years, mourn the loss of loved ones who perished on September 11th, 2001, during the most bloody attack on American soil from a foreign enemy in our nation's history. And if anybody would like to receive the MP3 of the interview I did last Friday with Staff Sergeant David Carnes, a true 9/11 hero, who rescued two Port Authority police officers from certain death while they were buried underneath tons of rubble from the collapsed Twin Towers. If you would like to receive that MP3, just make sure you email me at chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com, and we'll send the MP3 of our interview with Staff Sergeant David Carnes to you. And by the way, that rescue mission that Staff Sergeant Carnes successfully completed was the story that Oliver Stone's movie World Trade Center was entirely based on. So it's indeed a fascinating story. And today I am so delighted to have on the program for the very first time the Constitution Party candidate for President of the United States, Darrell Castle. And Darrell was born in 1948 in Kingsport, Tennessee, earning a Juris Doctorate from Memphis State University. He currently resides in Germantown, Tennessee. He is a veteran serving as a second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps and trained under First Lieutenant Oliver North. After graduation from basic school, Darrell's unit received a unit citation for being deployed in five different theaters of operation at the same time. He was promoted to First Lieutenant and received orders to the Far East for 13 months. His service in Vietnam followed a family military tradition, his oldest brother serving in the Army during World War II, another brother having served as a Marine in the Korean War. He firmly believes in upholding Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution, which makes it clear that only Congress can declare war and that those powers are not granted to the president. He is married to Joan Weil, and they have been happily married for nearly 40 years, and they have one daughter. In 1984, Darrell opened a private law firm, which later grew into Darrell Castle and Associates, based in Memphis, Tennessee. Since then, he has opened law firms in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Detroit, Michigan, Kansas City, Missouri, and St. Louis, Missouri. And Darrell has a very strong Christian religious ethic. He is founder of Maya's Children Foundation, mayaschildren.org, a Christian mission in Bucharest, Romania, which ministers to homeless gypsy children. His political activism includes two terms as the Constitution Party of Tennessee State Chairman, three terms as the Vice Chairman of the National Committee of the Constitution Party, two terms as the Platform Chairman of the National Convention of the Constitution Party, instructor of the Institute on the Constitution course, author of numerous articles and commentaries addressing national issues and analysis of current events, a board member of the Conservative Caucus since 2005, 2007 chairman of the National Veterans Coalition and outreach of the National Constitution Party, 2008 Constitution Party vice presidential candidate, running mate of Chuck Baldwin, and creator and author of the Castle Report. It's my honor and privilege to welcome you to Iron Sharpens Iron for the very first time, Daryl Castle.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be with you.
In fact, let me right off the bat give our email address again for those of you listening who want to submit a question of your own for Daryl Castle. Our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And we would hope that you include your first name, at least your city and state and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. In fact, we not long ago had an email from Heidelberg, Germany, from an enthusiastic supporter of Daryl Castle. So we do have listeners all over the globe. But Daryl, if you could give us some basic background of your own personal political ideology, when in your life you began to develop any interest in politics, and perhaps the journey that you took, perhaps you weren't always believer in limited government or what have you. It may have taken different forms in different times of your life, but if you could tell us something about your upbringing and so on.
Well, I was raised on a small farm in East Tennessee. My parents were subsistence farmers, meaning that we raised what we needed to eat and not much else, but we had no debt, and they were salt of the earth type people. So that's the background that I came from. But really, I was a true believer, as you pointed out. No, I haven't always been a believer in limited government. I really didn't understand these things. I mean, it was not till I was in the Marine Corps that I come to understand that the government occasionally lied and occasionally exceeded its constitutional powers and so forth. But I was essentially apolitical after I came back from the Far East until 1991. And in 1991, I met a man who asked me who I was going to vote for in that election. And I said, I'm probably going to sit this one out, it looks like. And he said, well, why don't you call my friend Howard Phillips? He's trying to start a new party. So a long story short, I did call Howard, and I was one of the original people that Howard put together to form the Constitution Party. So I was one of the founders of, I think all the others are dead now, I believe, but I've been involved in the Constitution Party since 1992 when it was founded.
Yes, in fact, I was an advertising salesman for a major Christian radio station in the 90s, and I actually sold the Constitution Party an ad campaign, and Howard Phillips did the voice for the ad, and this is when he was running for president. And I also arranged an interview, at least one interview for him. I didn't personally conduct it because I wasn't a talk host back then, but I arranged at least one interview with him. Well, I'm sorry, but I interrupted you. You can continue.
No, that's, you didn't. That's I just stayed involved in the party and worked within it and fulfilled the various roles that were placed in front of me, and you know, that kind of leads me to where I am now. I did do a lot of hard work, a lot of study, and a lot of personal observations to arrive at some of the conclusions. Of course, I was mentored, even though Howard was only about 7 years older than me. He was kind of a political father, and so I learned a lot under his mentorship, and did my own book, and that brings me to the conclusions of today.
If you could, this is a Christian talk program, a conservative evangelical Christian talk program. If you could tell our listeners something about your faith, because that usually is of utmost importance to Christian voters in some way, shape, or form. If you could tell us, our listeners,
sure,
something about that.
I'd be glad to do that. I'm a member of an evangelical Presbyterian church, and my wife and I are, and I've been a Christian. I was raised in a Christian home, but Yeah, my wife wasn't. She was raised in a Jewish home.
Hmm.
And she became a Christian much to the chagrin of her parents, who really didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
They assumed that it was my influence on her. She became a Christian before I did. She was saved at a Billy Graham crusade back in the mid-70s when
wow.
we first met. 1976, I think it was, when Billy Graham was here in Memphis. And it was her Christian life that I saw lived out in front of me that started the change in me. So, you know, that it's an odd sort of thing, but I was married to a Jew, and she became a Christian before I did.
And this political views, these political views that you developed, when did this finally lead to you wanting to actually run for office? And I assume, unless I'm mistaken, that the first time you ran was when you were a vice presidential candidate with Chuck Baldwin.
Well, yes, how that happened was we had our national convention in Kansas City that year, in 2008, and I had a law office in Kansas City, coincidentally, so it was kind of like a second hometown for me. And I was driving down the street one day as the convention was just getting ready to start with another gentleman, and I got this call from Chuck Baldwin, and Chuck said, would you consider being my my running mate? And, well, I was kind of shocked, to be honest about it, but I said, sure, Chuck, I'll consider it. So I went back to the hotel and talked to my wife, and we prayed about it, and I talked to Howard, who told me that he had recommended me to Chuck. And, of course, I had a lot of respect for Chuck, so I said yes. And, I mean, I was as shocked by that call as anyone, but nevertheless, that's what happened. And then this time, I just grew in the party, and the party wanted me. They drafted me. I mean, that's the term they use at the convention to nominate me. So that's how I became a candidate.
Well, if you could let our listeners know some of the distinctives that the Constitution Party has, most professing conservative Christians, as you are no doubt aware of, tend to vote Republican. And some erroneously think that that is actually a synonym. Christian and Republican are actually synonyms in the minds of many people. But there are very important distinctives that the Constitution Party would hold to that would make them, in the minds of many of the adherents and active members, no less conservative or patriotic or no less driven by biblical morality than the most conservative or Republican. So what would be the distinctives that would set the Constitution Party apart?
Well, if you look at our platform, you'll see that right there in the preamble, we are not ashamed to name the name of Jesus. But the other thing is that we adhere to the original intent of the founders of this nation. As I've said in many speeches during this election, this party was founded on the same principles that this country was founded on, and that is, number one, rights come from God, not from government.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Jefferson put that right in the Declaration. But number two, government should be limited. And I've got a speech coming up in Missouri on Constitution Day, which is next Saturday. That is the subject of it. What do we mean by the term limited government? But the founders said that government should be, the federal government, that it should be limited to 17 enumerated powers, which they set out in Article 1, Section 8. So we believe that's still relevant today and can still be defended. Some other differences is that the Republican Party has had the pro-life plank in their platform for many years. They've never adhered to it or paid any attention to it, really. But we actually do. Our candidates are going to have to adhere with the platform, which says we're pro-life without exception. We believe in secure borders. The Republicans supposedly do too, but they've never really followed that or adhered to it. Going all the way back to Ronald Reagan's amnesty program, they violated that pledge. So many other things like that. You know, today, here we are. We do follow a non-interventionist foreign policy, but I understand that it's hard to really understand what threats this country faces until you have access to briefings by military leaders and the leaders of our 16 intelligence agencies and things of that nature. But there are a lot of similarities between us and the most conservative Republicans. In fact, there's a whole social media group called Cruisers and Paulers for Castle. There's a Republicans for Castle. So a lot of the people that supported Ted Cruz have come my way and do support me now, and also some of the more conservative libertarian groups.
Yeah, something that you said struck me as being a difference that you would have from many of the libertarians in the mainstream. Now, I've heard that you have declared that you are more libertarian than Gary Johnson, the candidate for president of the United States for the Libertarian Party. And I have heard Gary Johnson and other libertarians, even Christian libertarians, state that they don't believe in the having very strictly patrolled and enforced borders of our nation. And that puzzled me because I didn't see having strong borders of our nation would in any way conflict with libertarian ideology. So I was puzzled by that firm stand by some of the libertarians I've had conversations with. But if you could explain why you think you are even more libertarian than Gary Johnson, and what about the inconsistency that they seem to have about the strong borders? If most libertarians are isolationists to a degree, or at least believe in America first, I'm not sure why they would be opposed to strong borders. That's basically what I'm trying to ask.
Well, one, Chris, I've never said that I'm more libertarian than
you. Okay, so that was a fable.
People have said that about me. It's a common theme on the internet and on some of my Facebook groups and so forth, but people have said that about me. I've never actually said it. But
okay.
If I really wanted to be a libertarian, I'd be in the Libertarian Party, but I do have certain libertarian tendencies because I believe in liberty, but I personally, the libertarians can correct me if I'm wrong because I don't want to speak for them, but I personally don't think it's inconsistent for Mr. Johnson to support open borders. I do think that's a fairly libertarian idea, and that is that that people from around the world, no matter where they are, should be free to come and go and live anywhere they want without restriction. That's the idea in liberty. You know, if a Mexican citizen wants to walk across the border and live in Texas, so be it. That's the way they see it, I think.
That's a good way to lose your liberties, though, if you have anybody coming into your country.
Well, that is just exactly right. I had a person point out to me today that, in fact, it was given in a speech, Dr. Paul said that, to sum up briefly what he said was, if you cut off welfare benefits to people living here illegally, they'll kind of self-deport. And if they don't, what difference does it make? Because they won't be getting they won't be living at the expense of American taxpayers. But I might point out that that doesn't solve the problem of terrorists and people with infectious diseases that we've never been exposed to and things like that coming across the border. So it doesn't solve the whole problem.
We do have a listener in Ocala, Florida, Justin, who asks, what will you do to strengthen our military here at home, and how will you bring reform to the VA and other institutions that care for our veterans?
Well, I mean, I'm a veteran, and I might point out I'm the only veteran in the race that's of a legitimate party. There's a gentleman running for or what he calls the Veterans Party, I think, but of legitimate parties that have access to the ballot, I'm the only one. So, I mean, I do have a heart for veterans, and I do believe that this country should live up to the promises that it makes to them. And it seems like a fairly simple matter to allocate enough resources to the VA to solve these problems. We can afford to give billions of dollars to what amounts to an enemy in Iran, and we can do many other things, but we can't take care of our veterans. So my advice to the civilian leadership of the country would be, if they don't only care for wounded veterans, they shouldn't get so many of them wounded. So that would be one of the first things I would do, would be try to prevent so many of these men from being, and women too, from being killed and wounded. So I would respect their lives and treat them very dearly. It's something that makes me very angry when I see what's being expected of the military, and how so many, I mean, probably all remember when President Obama was first elected, he came up with the idea that he would have wounded veterans pay for their own health care. That's something we've forgotten, but he rolled that one out there. It didn't work very well, but it kind of shows the whole attitude, which I would work very hard to see changed. I hope that answers the question. I know it's long on rhetoric and short on specifics, but that's all I have right now.
Well, you could be as long as you want with your answers. And by the way, Justin, since you are a first-time questioner on Iron Sharpens Iron, if you give us your full address, you are going to get a beautiful new Bible, compliments of the publishers of the New American Standard Bible. So if you'd like to email me your full mailing address, we'll get that out to you as soon as possible. Thanks to our friends also at the Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, cvbbs.com, who ship out all of our books and Bibles that our listeners win by submitting questions every single week, sometimes every day. They ship those out to our listeners. So thanks to cvbbs.com, you'll be getting that in the mail very soon. And you brought up a very interesting point, because this is the area where some Bible-believing, patriotic, conservative Americans and conservative Christians make the error of thinking that a cautious government that does not entangle our military in foreign affairs that are not our business, they view that as liberalism in many circles. Now, if you could distinguish between the more liberal understanding of pacifism, if you will, and what you are saying about limiting the areas on the globe and the instances that would require our military to participate in combat and so on.
Well, true pacifist is completely nonviolent and won't even defend himself or his own family when they are threatened with death or harm and so forth. I am certainly not that. You can ask my wife about that to a fault, but I do believe in self-defense, and I do believe in national defense. I mean, I'm an ex-Marine Corps officer, and I think that... you know, I've seen something of war, and I know that there's nothing glorious about it. And at the time I was in the Marine Corps, as I said, I was a true believer. I mean, it just simply would never have occurred to me that that my country would send so many people to war on nothing but a pack of lies. And I thought all those people, those kids out there, the same age as me, basically, demonstrating on college campuses and stuff, were just like traitors. I mean, they were just wrong, misguided children. And I found out that I was the one that was wrong, that my country did lie to me. And I started to investigate these things, and I saw them for myself. So I don't like war, but I do understand that it is better than slavery. So I am willing to defend this nation to the last drop of blood, if that's what it takes. But I don't think we should go around the world looking for every rattlesnake's nest there is to to stick our noses into. I was reading the other day that since World War II, there have been about 50 wars, and we've been involved in all of them. You know, why is that? I mean, I try to tell people that war, the absence of war, is not isolationism. It's called peace. And so many of the things that we do just provoke enemies around the world. I mean, every one of those bombs and missiles and rifles has Made in the USA stamped on it. All these people have friends. But, you know, as I said, I'm certainly willing to commit our military to combat if it is in the strategic interest of this country. And if it isn't, then I'm not interested.
Mm. Yes. I have heard that every single foreign military conflict the United States has been involved in since World War II has not been a legal, congressionally declared war. Is that true?
Yes, that is obviously true. And I might point out that since we stopped using the congressional, constitutional requirements for war, we haven't won very many.
Mm.
You know, we may have accomplished our mission a few times in some of these secret wars we've been involved in Latin and South America and so forth, but I don't know if you can call our 25-year struggle in the Middle East, starting back with Desert Storm 1 all the way through now, as a great victory. Maybe since there have been no nuclear attacks on the United States, maybe it is a victory. I don't know, but I don't know. I mean, if it's worth the trillions in debt and the blood that's been shed on both sides, to me it just seems like a massive mistake.
We're going to be going to our first break right now. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own for Darrell Castle, we do have a few people waiting to have their questions asked and answered. But if you'd like to join them, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside of the good old USA. That's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. We'll be right back after these messages, so don't go away. There's more to come.
Chris Arnzen here, and I can't wait to head down to Atlanta, Georgia. And here's my friend Dr. James White to tell you why.
Hi, I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. I hope you join me at the G3 Conference, hosted by Pastor Josh Bice and Praise Mill Baptist Church, at the Georgia International Convention Center in Atlanta, January 19th through the 21st, in celebration of the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. I'll be joined by Paul Washer, Steve Lawson, D.A. Carson, Vody Balcom, Conrad Mbewe, Phil Johnson, Rosaria Butterfield, Todd Friel, and a host of other speakers who are dedicated to the pillars of what G3 stands for, gospel, grace, and glory. For more details, go to g3conference.com. That's g3conference.com.
Thanks, James. Make sure you greet me at the Iron Sharpens Iron exhibit booth while you're there.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute. a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnz and your host of Iron Sharpens Iron. If you just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours is Darrell Castle, who is the Constitution Party candidate for President of the United States. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question for Darrell Castle, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside of the good old USA. And if for some reason you prefer to remain anonymous, you may do so. But otherwise, please give us at least your first name and location. We have CJ in Lindenhurst, Long Island, New York, who asks, what is the motivation behind Darrell and other independent candidates who run races they must know that they cannot win? Aren't you just making it more likely that somebody even more diabolically opposed to Christian morals and ethics, Hillary Clinton, will win the election by the siphoning of votes from at least the better of two evils?
Well, that one is pretty easy to answer. I've answered it, I don't know, maybe 1,000 times in the last couple of months, but number one, the Constitution and the rule of law are at risk in this country. They're at risk from both of the major parties. I don't know if people would just stop and think for a minute what we're going to have when we have a government completely severed from law and from constitutional restraints. Now, Mrs. Clinton, she knows what the Constitution is, and she understands that she needs to mention it. I mean, she has no intention of ever following it or obeying its limitations. Mr. Trump doesn't even know what it is. He pointed out to him that it's the supreme law of the land. He would just look at you, I'm sure, because he recognizes no limits on his authority. I mean, to briefly sum up what is meant by my speech coming up on Saturday, when you say limited government, I mean, what do you want? Unlimited government? That's what you're going to have with these people. And so you have a series of elected dictators, and every year, every election cycle, I've been told this my entire 24 years in the Constitution Party, every election cycle, there's a lesser of two evils and a greater of two evils, but somehow they both turn out to be evil. And somehow every election, it just gets worse. So, as Christians, we can't think that way. You know, if you look in the book of Romans, chapter 3 and verse 8, it says clearly that we are under judgment if we try to achieve a good result by doing evil. We can't do that. Evil is evil. Christians need to stand for what they actually believe. And I will tell you something else. The Bible, many, many places, says, do not fear. We're directed to not live in fear. God is in control. And this time that we have on earth is just a blink of an eye compared to eternity. We can't spend our time here living in fear of something terrible. You have to trust God. If he wants Hillary Clinton to be elected, Hillary Clinton will be elected, and he must think that that's all we have. That's all we deserve. And, you know, it is all we deserve, to be honest about it, but I cry out for mercy, and he is the God of mercy. Maybe if we do what he told us to do, and that is to repent and seek his face in humility, that he would heal our land. I would suggest that until we do those things, we have no chance in this country to ever regain our liberty, and it's just going to get worse and worse because, quite frankly, this country is under the judgment of a just God for the 60 million innocent babies that it has killed. And until that is recompense is made good, and you won't do that by electing pro-abortion, lesser of two evils. That's the way I see it, Chris. I'm sorry for my rant. But
No. Like I said, you could be as free and as lengthy with your answers as you want to. If I need to interrupt you, I will. But believe me, it's a lot easier to interrupt somebody than it is to pull teeth. So I'm very, very pleased that you have the freedom to speak that way. And thank you, CJ, from Lindenhurst, Long Island, New York. We do have a listener from all the way in Kinross, Scotland, Murray, who says, now that the United Kingdom has voted to leave the European Union, would you take Obama's view that a new trade deal with the UK will join the back of the queue in terms of priority? As a Christian, would you consider it to be ethically acceptable to highlight the current poor health of rival, or would you take the view that any means are justified in keeping someone with anti-Christian views from the White House?
Well, let me address the Brexit first, and I will say that it was one of the happiest days of my recent life when I heard the news about it. I'm all for decentralization. The other thing is that as far as a trade deal with the UK, I'm in favor of trade deals on an individual basis. I'm not in favor of free trade agreements because I don't really think they're free and I don't really think they're about trade, but I'm in favor of the United States entering into agreements with Scotland or the UK to say, look, you ship us your materials and there'll be no tariff or duties, and we'll do the same for you. I think that's great. But I'm opposed to free trade agreements because they transfer the sovereignty of the United States over trade to international corporations and bureaucracies totally unaccountable to the American people. Now, as far as highlighting Hillary Clinton's health problems, there's more an issue there than just the morality of talking about somebody's poor health. The American people have a right to know whether this woman is in good enough health to hold that office. They have a right to know whether she has a brain disorder, whether she is really healthy enough to be commander-in-chief. I mean, what happens if she's sitting down at a meeting with Vladimir Putin and she faints like she did the other day and has to be carried out? What's that say about America? So absolutely we have a right to know about it, and it is just so obvious that she's being deceptive and lying about it that certainly I think and the deceptive media, her handmaidens in the whole thing, you know, we need to know whether this woman is physically able to perform the duties. I certainly would be very, very nervous if I knew that my son or daughter was out there serving in the military with her as commander-in-chief, that's for sure. I think I got all the questions in there, Chris. I hope so.
Yes, it looks that way. And thank you so much, Murray from Kinross, Scotland, for participating with that great couple of questions there. And we do have Harrison from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. I have heard that your vice presidential running mate is a Mormon. Is this true? And do you think that this is a conflict of the Christian identity of the Constitution Party?
Yes, he is a Mormon, and no, I don't see it as a conflict. The chairman of our party is also a Mormon. We believe, unlike what people accuse us of occasionally, which is trying to enact a theocracy, we do believe in religious freedom in the Constitution Party. We take the First Amendment very seriously, as we do all of the Bill of Rights. And Scott Bradley is my running mate. I've known him for at least 20 years. He's a dear friend. I trust him completely, 100%. He's a very eloquent defender of the Constitution, which is, after all, what our name is.
Mm-hmm.
I would say in all sincerity that he's an expert in the land issues in the West, especially where the federal government owns 90% of Nevada, 70% of Wyoming, and many other states. Shocking, but nevertheless true. So if elected, we would endeavor to do something about that. So those are some of the reasons why I chose Scott.
Well, thank you, Harrison, in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. And tell us about, if you could, some more things that would contrast the political identity and ideology of you and the Constitution Party as opposed to a mainstreamer in the GOP.
Well, I mean, that's hard to say, except the mainstreamer in the GOP, they have so much in common with the mainstreamer in the Democrat Party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Howard and I, when we were forming this, and the other gentlemen who were involved in the formation of the party, I used to ask Howard these things about why he was doing this. You know, he was one of the men that he served in the Nixon administration, and he was one of the people who went into the president on that fateful day and said, Mr. President, for the good of the nation, you have to resign. So he had paid his dues politically, and he told me that in his view, the Republican and Democratic parties were never, ever going to let this country be free and to take it where it wanted to go. I'll tell you another difference, Chris, and that is that, what kind of presidential candidate says he's run specifically to limit the power of the presidency, to hold the presidency to its constitutionally enumerated powers and nothing else? Instead, they all want to expand the presidency, and they want to expand their own power to give more control, to institute more illegal, unconstitutional executive orders, and to rule and legislate in clear violation of Article 1, Section 1 from the White House and so forth. So both parties do those things, and as a party, we are absolutely 100% opposed to them. So those are some more differences.
We have Tyler in Mastic Beach, Long Island, New York, who asks, why is it that the mainstream evangelicals in America are by default taking the identity of the Republican Party? Of course, the evangelicals should never vote for liberals due to their approval of a sinful rebellion to God.
Well, I can't speak for all these people, but I have been around a while, and I have been in many, many meetings. In 2008, when I was a vice presidential candidate, I was invited to a meeting of top Republican operatives. There was about 50 people in the room. Everybody you've ever heard of who is in the evangelical wing of the Republican Party was there. And the purpose of the meeting was to discuss whether if the Republicans nominated a pro-abortion candidate on either side of the ticket, would they consider supporting me or some other third party? And we talked about it for quite a while. They gave me 2 minutes to speak, they finally said no, they would not do that. They would not leave the Republican Party no matter what, in other words. So another way they've expressed it from time to time, quite famously, is what difference does it make if you get a seat at the table but nobody passes you the meat or potatoes? You know, in the Republican Party, in their minds, they're players. You know, they can deliver votes to a Republican candidate of their choosing, and these people will cater to them. On a tiny, tiny scale, I understand that feeling, because I occasionally have somebody who comes to me and who has maybe a blog that's pretty influential and a lot of people read it and is willing to endorse me if I will do and say certain things and that sort of thing. But the Republicans, in the evangelical Republicans, feel like that they're players in the Republican Party, that they have influence, that the Republican Party has to listen to them because they can deliver 5 million votes. That used to be the term that was used. We can deliver 5 million votes anytime we want to. And so certain Republican candidates were forced to lie to them. And they like to be lied to, you know, certain things, you know, your wife or husband, you know, the old classic joke, does this dress make me look fat? you're supposed to say, oh, no, honey, not at all. the evangelical Republicans apparently enjoy being lied to because they've been lied to my whole political life as much as I can remember, and they just keep coming back for more. So they must enjoy it.
And one of the things that I have in conversation reminded my fellow conservative evangelical Christians, when they enthusiastically support something that a so-called conservative president might do, involving some kind of increase in government power, like, for instance, things that were involved with Homeland Security and so on, the thing that I remind them about is that you might be pleased now with that kind of increase in government power, but when somebody who is diametrically opposed to everything you stand for is in that office, you're not going to be happy with that. Is that a good way of warning people about government power? Because they seem to be okay with it if somebody that they like is in the White House, but that could only last 8 years.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Chris. That is a very good example of why we need a rule of law, why we need a constitution, because government has to be limited to a written document. Because just as you say, the dictator that you elect today may be benevolent, although he could be lying.
Right.
He might be benevolent, but the dictator that's elected the next time might not be so benevolent. You know, it's the old story. Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany, and it turns out he wasn't very benevolent. Most of them start out as elected officials, and then all of a sudden they declare themselves president for life or something like that. But people can't see these kind of things happening in America. But I'll tell you, the founders did. They understood human nature. They understood human nature as it's set out in the Bible and in the holy writings and so forth. They understood that, as the Bible says, the human heart is black and desperately wicked.
Mm-hmm.
You can know it. Government has to be restrained by a written document. It has to be held down by that document. That's what the rule of law is, and you simply cannot surrender that unless you surrender your liberty.
We have Arnie in Perry County, Pennsylvania, who says, I understand that you believe in very strong borders to protect the safety and liberty of those living here in the United States, but what would your idea of rectifying the situation be when it comes to illegal aliens living here? Would you ruthlessly deport all of them, no matter what kind of lifestyles and contributions to this country they are making now? Or would you be more selective in the way you deported illegal aliens?
No, I am not in favor of mass deportations. I am in favor of identifying and deporting terrorists whenever they can be identified.
Right.
Or doing something else with them besides deportation. But I am not in favor of mass deportations. I really am. I just couldn't do that. And I think if we simply deny benefits to them, if we say there are no social services that, if you want to call it welfare, that's available only to American citizens, period. I think you'll see a lot of self-deportation, but I'm not in favor of a mass deporting of people. You know, sometimes when you think of people as a massive group, you don't see any faces, but when you stop at a gas station sometime, you see steam coming out of their radiator, and they have no money to get their car fixed, and their children are upset. You know, that's not the way it is. Your heart is filled with compassion for them. And you ask yourself, would I deport those people? And my answer is no, I would not do it.
Now, I'm assuming that you are, since you're a constitutionalist, that you're a strong believer in the Second Amendment. And having said that, do you believe there should be any requirements for or restrictions against gun ownership, and if there would be any restriction against certain types of weaponry for a private citizen to own.
No, I don't believe in any.
On any of those.
Well, no, I mean, I know what the next comment most people will make. So you think if a person wanted to have a tank, for example, he could have a tank. Well, I suppose so. I mean, you know, if an individual wanted to buy a tank for himself, I suppose it would be okay. But I don't believe in restrictions on the Second Amendment, no.
Now, even for the individual purchasing firearms, for instance, if somebody is out on parole after a mass murder, what would the freedoms and liberties in regard to gun ownership for that person be?
Well, I should have stipulated that that's for people not convicted of violent felonies and so forth. I don't think convicted murderers should have access to firearms if they could possibly be denied that.
Now, since there seems to be some similarities between your views of limited government and the libertarians, especially the paleo-libertarian, the more historic libertarians, what is your view about the prison system itself? Do you think that there's a better alternative to punishing criminals than keeping them in cages and so on? And then often, maybe even cages is a poor terminology because today they're very often living in like luxury hotels, but, and feeding them and a very exorbitant, cost to, the United States, to maintain these sometimes very luxurious homes for these prisoners, or even if you want to say a poorly run prison that is more like a caged system, if you will, whatever the case may be, is there a better alternative to the prison system to punish criminals?
Well, I think there has to be. The criminal justice system needs to really be looked at in America. A lot of the problem is that, I'm certainly not in favor of letting violent felons out after only a few months. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there are tens of thousands of laws and regulations out there that punish nothing harmful. And so many people... just we're going through a controversy here in my city of Memphis right now, where there's a motion pending before the city council to reduce the punishment for possession of marijuana in small amounts, meaning amounts below the limit designated as intent to sell, by making it a $50 misdemeanor fine. So the city council is debating those issues now. And as part of that, they mentioned that 80% of all drug convictions in this county is for possession of small amounts of marijuana, which is amazing to me. I just don't see sending people to prison for something like that. I really don't. I would be in favor of decriminalizing it, and if a person has a problem as an addict or something, perhaps he could be treated medically like any other disorder. Like if you had an alcoholic and he sought treatment or was referred for treatment, he would not be imprisoned for doing that. That's the way I see it, and I think you could greatly reduce the population, but... in an ideal world, people who are convicted of property crimes should be required to work and produce income so that they could return something to the victims of their crime. But as a judge told me one time, we don't live in an ideal world, do we? So how that could be done, I'm not quite sure, but it seems to me that it makes more sense than just, as you put it, locking people in cages for the rest of their lives at a cost of some $50,000 a year.
Now, would you think that it's time for the whole war on drugs to be overturned and done away with? Because a lot of, again, I'm repeating things that a lot of conservative evangelical Christians immediately equate that kind of talk with liberalism. And yet, most of the conservative evangelicals who would be in favor of the war on drugs would not be in favor of bringing the country back to the days of prohibition when alcohol was made illegal, because many people recognize, number one, that failed miserably, and number two, it really gave rise to organized crime. It gave birth to it. But what is your opinion on the war on drugs in general?
Tell me something today that has given birth to more crime than the war on drugs.
Right.
Close to all the crime that we have is drug-related. Yes, I am very much in favor of declaring peace in the war on drugs. You know, we started using the term war for these things back in the 60s. We declared war on drugs, war on cancer, war on poverty. And everything we declared war on, now we've got more of it than ever. I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it is a way to expand profits and so forth. Yes, I think the war on drugs should be ended, and I think drug addicts should be treated medically and so forth, and other solutions should come along, and I think it would reduce crime, it would reduce the prison population, it would just make this a more peaceful society. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see it. And I can point to other countries. Portugal is the poster child for that. They certainly reduced their crime rate to almost nothing by doing it. So it makes sense. It's a liberty issue. It's a moral issue. For, as you pointed out, a lot of Christians, they freak out when you say that because they see it as liberalism. But however you want to see it, it's a moral issue. It's immoral to do what we are doing with the war on drugs and with the way we prosecute drug crimes. That's my view anyway.
Now, when you said the drug addicts should be treated medically, at whose expense?
That's a good question, and it's a fair question. And I don't know the answer to it offhand. It's certainly, I know who is bearing the expense of prosecuting them and imprisoning them right now. So, and I know who's bearing the expense of their crimes, their continual robberies and burglaries and so forth to feed their habit. So it seems to me that something could be worked out to resolve the issue.
We're going to be going to another break right now, and if you'd like to join us, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence. If you live outside of the USA, you may remain anonymous if it makes you feel more comfortable. So don't go away.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnzen, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wng.org/ironsharpens today.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Tired of box store Christianity? Of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnson of Iron Sharpens Iron. If you just tuned us in for the full 2 hours today, our guest has been and will be Darrell Castle, who is the Constitution Party candidate for President of the United States of America. If you'd like to join us, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen at gmail.com. And if you choose to remain anonymous, we will accommodate you if that is something that makes you feel more comfortable, but we would prefer that you let us know where you are, what city, state, and country. And again, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. We have a listener in Massapequa, Long Island, New York, Terrence, who asks, I know that your guest has vast experience and background in the military. What is his view on the draft? And if a draft would ever include women?
Well, no, a draft would never include women, in my view, under no circumstances, over my dead body kind of thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm opposed to the draft, period, because I'm opposed to human slavery. And, you know, can I search the recesses of my mind and see a situation where I would do that rather than see the nation destroyed? I suppose it's humanly possible that I could, but in general, I'm certainly opposed to it.
Great. Well, we have Pastor Bruce in Center Reach, Long Island, New York, who says, to what extent should civil government have on any level be helping to the poor?
Didn't hear the last part of the question.
To what extent should civil government on any level be helping the poor?
Boy, that's a good question, and it's I appreciate the pastor asking it. I think the poor should be helped voluntarily, and when it's involuntary, who's really helping? I mean, If your next door neighbor, if I broke into his house and stole his property and told him that I was going to use it to help the poor, would that justify? If I had a pizza joint in Philadelphia somewhere and two men came in one day and said, hey, it's a nice place you got here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. But if you pay us, then nothing will happen to it. Okay, if I don't pay them, government takes property from us by force. Many people will tell me, well, even if I weren't required to. Well, okay, that one's on you, but they take our property by force and distribute it to whoever they will. So I'm not in favor. I don't see any provision for that in the Constitution. And, you know, there's an old story that we put on a brochure that we hand out to people in this party. And that brochure is called Not Yours to Give. And it's a story about Davy Crockett when he was in Congress. Davy Crockett, of course, was a congressman from my state of Tennessee who died at the Alamo. But Crockett, when he was in Congress, there was a bill that came up to give $10,000 off taxpayer money to the widow of a prominent general who had served the country faithfully and had died. And Crockett stood up and said, you know, I'm the poorest man in Congress, but I will make the first contribution to this woman, and I would ask the rest of you to do the same thing, because as far as giving her money from the taxpayers, it's not ours to give. So I suppose that would be my answer.
And Pastor Bruce wants to invite our listeners to a conference, a free conference, September 23rd through the 24th, The Biblical View of Government, A Christian Response to Politics. One of the main speakers is Dr. David C. Innes of the King's College, Professor of Politics, Philosophy, and Economics. And for more details on this conference, which will be held at the Word of Truth Church in Farmingville, Long Island, New York, you can call 631 area code, 806-0614. That's 631-806-0614. Or you can also go to the Word of Truth Church website, which is wotchurch.com. That's wotchurch.com. And that W-O-T stands for Word of Truth, church.com. And so we thank Pastor Bruce for submitting that question. And it's our privilege to help plug a very fascinating conference, it looks like, that you have there. The Biblical View of Government, A Christian Response to Politics, at the Word of Truth Church in Farmingville, Long Island, New York, Friday and Saturday, September 23rd and 24th. There is another confusion about limited government that is also causes some evangelical conservative Bible-believing Christians to wonder about the repercussions of a government that is too small. For instance, in regard to marriage, there are libertarians, even libertarians who are very personally conservative and biblical in their moral values, but they don't believe a government should have any restriction on either polygamy or same-sex marriage. They think that the government doesn't have any business at all in marriage. Is your view of the government that limited, where people could basically marry anybody or anything they want to marry?
Well, let me say it like this, Chris. I'm a Christian. And I'm opposed to same-sex marriage. In fact, I don't even think there's any such thing as same-sex mm-hmm. marriage. God defines clearly what marriage is. And if I were president of the United States and two people came to me of the same gender and they said, we're married. Here's a liberal priest, a liberal pastor, and a civil magistrate who will testify to the fact that we're married. My answer would be, I don't care what those people say. As far as I'm concerned, you're not married. But as far as my government is concerned, it's none of our business. You know, if you want to have a relationship, call it whatever you want to. That's up to you. And so I think the libertarians would take the position that as long as force isn't used, in other words, if you want to talk about the polygamist, if the polygamist doesn't force those women to cohabitate with him, you know, it's their business. Now, you know, if you want to talk about marrying dogs and cats and stuff, I suppose you get into cruelty to animals. I don't want to cede to the government the authority to define what marriage is. I don't want to give them the right to say yes or no to same-sex marriage. As I said, I am inalterably opposed to it, but I don't want my government to tell me what my marriage is, and it's too much power, and that's my answer.
Well, the flip side of the coin, though, is should the government be able to force you and I to recognize two men as a marriage? I mean, that's where the issue is.
No, I certainly wouldn't be in favor of that, not at all. As I just said, I would tell those two people, as far as I'm concerned, you're not married, period.
Right. So whatever business that you happen to be the owner of, or if you're renting an apartment or whatever the circumstance where you would be discriminating, and by the way, for people who shudder when they hear the word discriminate, it's a completely legitimate word. It doesn't mean that there's necessarily hate attached to anything. When you choose one thing over another, you're discriminating for a reason. So discrimination is something we all do, and it can be very good and very important, in fact, very vital. But when it comes to saying, for instance, I'm not going to rent my home to you to live in because I don't recognize the fact that you two men are married and I don't approve of the way you live, that should be a complete liberty for a homeowner to exercise that right of discrimination, if you will, or discernment, correct?
Absolutely. People should be able to enter into social relationships as they see fit or not as they see fit. To do otherwise is just government tyranny. I mean, one of my opponents, Gary Johnson, is quite famous for taking the position that in that case of the birthday cake, that bakers should be forced to bake birthday cakes for same-sex couples, or not birthday, but wedding cakes for same-sex couples against their will and so forth. I most strenuously disagree with that. He also said that he believed that Jews should be required to bake cakes for Nazis.
Why on earth would a libertarian say that the government should force anybody to do something like that? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, he obviously doesn't have an understanding of what religious liberty really is. You know, I try to talk to people about it. In this country, we have religious freedom, or at least we're supposed to. You know, in France, they don't have a history of religious freedom. At least they haven't since 1789 in the French Revolution, when the churches were destroyed. But so France is free to tell Muslim women that they can't wear burqas. But here in America, we can't do that because we have religious freedom. We don't want Muslims in the country, that's one thing, but we can't tell them they can't wear burqas once they're here. But yes, he seems to have a very misguided view of what religious freedom is, and he certainly believes, having no faith himself, I suppose, he believes that it's meaningless and that the government's free to override it at will.
Yeah, well, he doesn't seem to understand what libertarianism is either.
I mean, you're not the first person to point that out.
Right. We do have Don in Canton, Mississippi, who asks, my question has to do with Convention of the States, Article 5. My view on this isn't the right time due to the corruption at the state levels. Is this why Mr. Castle is against it at this time?
Well, that's one of the reasons I'm against it, that the states are just as corrupt as the federal government. A lot of people don't understand that, I think, but I'm against it for many other reasons. I mean, we don't follow the Constitution that we have. Why do we think that we would be somehow forced to follow the amended Constitution? I've seen several, I guess, five or six different versions. the governor of Texas proposed a version. I think he had 9 proposed amendments. And some of the amendments basically just say that the government should be forced to follow the Constitution. In other words, one of the governor's suggestions was that we amend the Constitution to say that the government should follow the Constitution. But anyway, not to make light of the situation, because I know that it's very dear to a lot of people, but I'm opposed to it.
Could you explain in a little more detail what this is, the ramifications of all that are?
Well, there are many people out there who want to have an Article 5. Article 5 of the Constitution allows the Constitution to be amended by a different system than what we traditionally have used to amend it. The states could call it through Congress and so forth, and they would meet in convention, and the convention would vote these amendments that are proposed up or down. Most of the proposals that you see believe that it could be limited to simply the amendments that are before the convention. In other words, they couldn't take over the convention and use it to completely undo the entire Constitution. But if you had a convention that listed three potential amendments or 5 potential amendments, whatever it might be, that those would be the only ones considered. I have my doubts about that, but that's kind of how it would work. And usually the amendments are things like to have a balanced budget, to have term limits for members of Congress and the Senate and so forth, things like that.
By the way, Don in Canton, Mississippi, if you give me your full mailing address, since you are a first-time questioner on Iron Sharpens Iron, you're going to get a beautiful free New American Standard Bible that has an embossed cross on the cover. It's really a very attractive Bible, one that is easily carried around, not quite small enough to fit in your pocket, but it could fit in a large coat pocket, and a woman could carry it in her pocketbook very easily. It's a perfect size for taking to hospitals and everywhere else you go. So just give us your full mailing address, and we'll have Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service ship that out to you as soon as possible. That's cvbbs.com. Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, we thank them again for shipping out all of the free Bibles and free books that our listeners win by submitting questions. We have Robert in White Plains, New York, who asks, what is your opinion on individual states having the freedom to secede from the Union if things got so bad in this country that they just felt there is no other option?
Well, if I said I didn't believe in that secession was a legitimate option, then I would have to throw the Declaration of Independence out the window. And Thomas Jefferson is too significant for me to do that. His words are far more eloquent than mine. So yes, I certainly believe in the right of secession. If people decide that government is no longer faithful to the interests for which the states formed the government, I might add, the states formed this compact, and there was nothing about it that said, by the way, this is binding forever, you can never get out of it. So if a state wants to secede, you know, that's their right. That's the way I see it anyway.
We do have a listener, Justin from Ocala, Florida, who wrote to us earlier. He asks, what is your opinion on the Black Lives Matter movement? Do you think there is at least a small portion of the movement who is trying to do good, or do you feel that they are being played as pawns negatively in something greater?
Yeah, the latter.
Yeah.
Played as I'm sure there are people in that movement. In fact, I know a couple of people in Memphis who are involved with it that are dear Christian people. I would not in any regard, in my view, they're misguided, but that's just my view. The movement in general, seems to be trying to foment chaos in the country. It seems like a racist movement, which I'm opposed to. So I will admit that I don't know everything about it, and as I just pointed out, I do know some people who are involved that are fine people and just believe that they're opposing discrimination and harassment and that type of thing, oppression is a word they would probably use. But in general, I don't see much good coming from it.
Let's see. We have John in Augusta, Maine, who asks, I have heard that the income taxes we pay, the federal income taxes we pay, go completely 100% to pay for the national debt, but pay for the interest on the national debt. Is this true?
No, that's not true. Interest on the national debt right now is running slightly less than $500 billion a year. And we're collecting in the neighborhood of $3 trillion in income taxes. No, that's not true. We are a $1 trillion deficit or close to it. The deficit may have fallen slightly below a trillion. But a trillion here and a trillion there, who counts? But what I mean by deficit, in case people don't know, is that's the amount of money that the government spends in excess of what it takes in. So it's borrowing close to $1 trillion a year and adding it to the debt. But no, it is not even close to the full taxpayer money in reference to interest on the debt as it exists now.
Well, on the flip side of the coin with that question, though, most people, if you ask them, where does your income tax go to? They would say, well, of course, that goes to keep the roads maintained and build bridges and goes to the military and goes to our public school system and all these things that we need to have a decent, orderly society. Is that true?
Help poor people and things like that. A lot of people would say that, I'm sure. And obviously it goes to all those things and many, many more. Something to keep in mind is since 2008, which is, 8 years now, the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates at near zero. There's two reasons for that. One of them is to try to spur velocity of the dollar, meaning it changes hands really fast, and they think that helps the economy. And the second reason is to make it easier for the government to fund its debt. If interest rates return to their historic averages, like 7%, it would destroy this country financially. The payments on the debt would skyrocket and would get out of control in no time. And it is a very frightening situation that anybody who serves in government, I'm sure, is painfully aware of. And, that's why you don't have to worry about the Federal Reserve raising rates more than half a point or something like that, because they simply can't do it. They can't fund the debt if they do it. So it is a scary situation that we live with every day. People sometimes don't realize how close to the edge this country lives financially from day to day. But the other reason for interest rates being low is to destroy savers. So that people, in this country, part of the American dream used to be that you could build a business, or you could save some money, or you could spend your life paying off a house. And let's say that you worked your whole working life, 40 years, we'll say, to pay off a home that when you get to the end of the 40 years, it's worth $500,000. Not uncommon in today's world. And so you can take that $500,000 and invested in government bonds at 6% and get maybe $50,000 a year for the rest of your life as income, and that and Social Security, you and your wife can have a pretty good life. That's all gone now. There's no such thing anymore because interest rates are at zero. So it's destroyed savings. Well, what's the advantage of that for the federal government? Well, we're all dependent on them, especially the elderly. You have no other choice except to cast yourself into their hands and say, oh, please Please don't do anything about Social Security because I wouldn't be able to live without it. You know, please don't do anything about Medicare or Medicaid because my life depends on it. And that is the, I think, the fourth reason for interest rates being at zero.
Now, a former contestant in this political race, Ted Cruz, believed that the IRS should be abolished and federal income tax should be abolished. What are your views on those things?
I agree with Ted Cruz 100%. In fact, the Constitution Party's original phone number was 1-800 to veto IRS.
That's right. I remember that.
Yes, we believe in, imagine what it would feel like for the average American if they could keep all their income. How could that happen? How could you fund the government? Well, you could fund the government with a constitutional tax. And by that, I mean a tax that complies with the original intent of the Constitution before it was amended by the 16th Amendment, giving the federal government the right to tax our income. And that would be a tax apportioned according to census to the state. In other words, if my state of Tennessee had 2% of the nation's population, then Tennessee would be required to produce 2% of the budget. So it would be, and they could collect that money as they see fit. Tennessee might choose to tax its country music industry. It might choose to charge a fee for entry into parks. In Alaska, they might tax their petroleum industry. In Florida and Hawaii, they might tax tourism. And in Nevada, it would probably be gambling. But they could raise the money as they saw fit. But what that would do is, it would, and by the way, the original Constitution said that the federal government would not tax our income. They were prohibited from taxing us directly. So it would free up massive amounts of money for growth in this country. It would make the federal government recognize state sovereignty. The representatives of the people, their congressmen, would be going to Washington trying to hold down the budget rather than the other way around. And Washington would be disempowered. The states would be empowered. And finally, if Washington decided to have a war somewhere, let's go over to the Middle East and start a war. Well, they would have to ask, how are we going to pay for it? And if they said this is going to $1 trillion, they might come back to the state of Pennsylvania and say, look, we're going to have a $1 trillion war, and your share of that's going to be $200 billion. So get out there and raise some money. Well, you know, the people might come to question these things. All those things are very good, and we are free to have such a system. All it would take is to elect me president, and I'll make it happen.
We're going to be going to our final break. If you'd like to join us on the air, we have about a half hour left, and I would do so as soon as possible. I would email a question as soon as possible if you intend to, because believe me, a half hour goes by like a bullet. So the email address to send those questions in is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. A few of you are patiently waiting to have your questions asked and answered, and I will get to you as soon as possible, so don't worry, I haven't forgotten about you. But our email again is chrisarnson@gmail.com if anybody else would like to join us on the air with a question for Darrell Castle, the Constitution Party candidate for President of the United States of America. Don't go away, we're going to be right back with Darrell Castle after these messages.
Chris Arnson here, and I can't wait to head down to Atlanta, Georgia, and here's my friend Dr. James White to tell you why.
Hi, I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. I hope you join me at the G3 Conference, hosted by Pastor Josh Bice and Praise Mill Baptist Church, at the Georgia International Convention Center in Atlanta, January 19th through the 21st, in celebration of the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. I'll be joined by Paul Washer, Steve Lawson, D.A. Carson, Vodi Balcom, Conrad Mbewe, Phil Johnson, Rosaria Butterfield, Todd Friel, and a host of other speakers who are dedicated to the pillars of what G3 stands for, gospel, grace, and glory.
For more details, go to g3conference.com. That's g3conference.com.
Thanks, James. Make sure you greet me at the Iron Sharpens Iron exhibit booth while you're there.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750. That's 508-528-5750. Or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at providencebaptistchurchma.org, that's providencebaptistchurchma.org, or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Attention coin collectors and investors, Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York, has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, so order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling, and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com. Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is sponsored by Harvey Cedars, a year-round Bible conference and retreat center nestled on the Jersey Shore. Harvey Cedars offers a wide range of accommodations to suit groups up to 400. For generations, Christians have enjoyed gathering and growing at Harvey Cedars. Each year, thousands of high school and college students come and learn more about God's Word. An additional 9,000 come annually to Harvey Cedars as families, couples, singles, men, women, pastors, seniors, and missionaries. 90 miles from New York City, 70 miles from Philly, and 95 miles from Wilmington, and easily accessible, scores of notable Christian groups frequently plan conferences at Harvey Cedars, like the Navigators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Campus Crusade, and the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Find Harvey Cedars on Facebook or at hcbible.org, hcbible.org. Call 609-494-9400.
5689, 609-494-5689. RV Cedars, where Christ finds people and changes lives. Welcome back. This is Chris Arnzen for the last 90 minutes of the next half hour to come. Our guest today for the entire two-hour program has been and will be Darrell Castle, the Constitution Party candidate for President of the United States. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. We have Christopher, Suffolk County, Long Island, New York, who asks, if Ted Cruz was the Republican nominee for President of the United States, would you still be running for president under the Constitution Party?
Yes, I would, because I'm the party's candidate. I will say that if I were a Republican, and I'm not, that's one of the reasons why I would still be running, although it would be difficult not to support Senator Cruz, but if I had been a Republican, I would have voted for him in the primaries, but I am not, and I have never been a Republican.
Wow, you've never been a Republican.
No, I'm one of the few people that are clean out there. I have no political connections besides the Constitution Party.
Wow. Can anything come to mind right now where you would be in stark contrast to Senator Cruz's platform?
No, I really don't. I can't think of any. I'm sure there are some somewhere, but I cannot think of any offhand. I mean, he supports a different tax system than I do, but we both want to get rid of the IRS, so there's hardly a difference.
And how would you assess the political ideology of both Ron and Rand Paul, the father and son who ran on different political races for the White House?
Well, Ron Paul endorsed Chuck Baldwin and me in 2008, an endorsement that we were very happy to have. I mean, I share many of his views, his non-interventionist policy. I share his views on the economy. The return to the gold standard and the end of the Federal Reserve. I'm in favor of all those things. And Dr. Paul is like the poster child for them. Rand, slightly less so, because Rand is a U.S. Senator, and that brings pressures to bear on a person. There are certain people that have to be pleased, I suppose. I'm just guessing, but he did endorse Mitch McConnell, which kind of shocked people, but he's trying to survive in the Senate, and Ron never did that. He wanted to survive, but he didn't want that badly. So those are some differences, I suppose. But for those reasons that I mentioned, I'm certainly supporters of theirs.
Now, what was your reaction, or is your reaction, to Rand Paul's views on abortion? And there are other professing conservatives and professing conservative libertarians who would say that they are personally opposed to abortion and believe that it should be settled as a states' rights issue. How do you respond to that?
I think that's a cop-out, and it's a way for people to gaff off the hard issues to the states and just say, let's just dump it on the states. But it's not a state's issue, and I quote the 5th and 14th Amendment, which says, no person may be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. The 14th Amendment has the exact same language, and it applies that language to the states, so it is incumbent upon the federal government to enforce the Bill of Rights, to protect the innocent, and it is incumbent on us as Americans to deny government the right to tell us who a person is, who can be a person, a very, very dangerous concept, Hitlerian in its ramifications, that the government has authority to say, you're a person, you're not a person. So anyway, I feel very strongly about abortion and about life.
Yes, so do I. One of the other things that I have heard in defense of Rand Paul's understanding of things is that murder is not a federal crime. It is under certain circumstances, but murder in general is a state crime. It's a crime against the state, not a federal crime. So how do you respond to that in regard to the abortion issue?
Well, that is absolutely true. He is correct in that assessment, but that doesn't solve the problem. Here you have a situation where an entire class of people, and I'll call them people, an entire group of people have been denied the basic civil right of life without any due process by simply declaring them not legal persons. And I think the federal government is obligated to do whatever can be done to protect the lives of the innocent. That's just my view.
We have a listener, Robert, who hasn't told us what city and state or country he's from. But Robert asks two questions. Would Mr. Castle do anything to encourage constitutional studies in our public schools? I'll let you answer that one first.
Well, there wouldn't be any public schools on the federal level if I were president, because the Department of Education would be abolished and education would be referred back to the states and local governments and to the people primarily. If the people wanted their state to have public schools, then that would be fine. If not, then they could do something else. But there'd be no federal involvement in education. But I would certainly hope the states would encourage constitutional education. I would certainly be in favor of that.
And his second question is, does Mr. Castle have any affiliation with the National Center for Constitutional Studies?
No, I do not.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that organization. But Robert, you are a first-time questioner on Iron Sharpens Iron, so if you give us your full address, we will have a free New American Standard Bible shipped to you. The compliments of the publishers of the NASB, and by the way, their website is nasbible.com, nasbible.com. But also, it will be shipped to you at no expense to you or to Iron Sharpens Iron by our friends at Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, cvbbs.com, cvbbs.com. And we thank Todd and Patty Jennings, owners of Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, for sponsoring and supporting Iron Sharpens Iron. And we hope that you continue to. The issue of limited government is, as we've been bringing out throughout this whole program, is a very controversial issue, and another one that is neck and neck with that is how and when our nation should be involved in foreign military conflict. Now, obviously, we've already made it clear that you believe that only Congress should be able to legally declare war. But when do you think, what would be like some of the examples of when, if any, the United States should go to war, if Congress should declare war on a foreign nation and require our military to be involved in it? Is there any issue that would be going on overseas that you would believe would require our involvement? Because there are some libertarians who are even conservative who believe that we should not be involved in a war with any foreign nation unless they are actually involved in attacking us in some way or on their way to drop bombs on us, something to do with a direct attack on American soil is the only way that these specific libertarians I'm speaking of believe we should be even involved in any kind of a war. What is your opinion on that?
Well, you have to admit that a direct attack on American soil is a pretty good reason
yes.
for a war.
Yes. But is it the only one?
You know, no, I don't think it's the only one. I mean, if we knew for certain that the Japanese fleet was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean going somewhere, and we found out for sure that they were coming to attack Pearl Harbor, would be justified in a retaliatory strike against Japan. Yes, I think we would. But it doesn't have to be that grand. I mean, the president has authority to act. He's supposed to notify Congress and get congressional approval if he uses the military without their approval for 60 days. After 60 days, he's supposed to come to Congress and say, this is my reason for doing this, and I'm going to ask you to authorize me to use force to solve this problem in Congress, unless it's the gutless lapdog that it's always been, can say yes or no. Let's take, for example, when President Reagan saw some communist soldiers in the island of Grenada down in the Caribbean, and he saw that as a direct threat to the United States. He acted. It was solved well within 60 days, and it was over with. The president has authority to do such things. It's made doubly difficult these days, as I'm sure you realize, by the fact that most of the conflicts in the world are non-state actors. In other words, we're not going to war against Russia or China or something like that. We're fighting a group of almost invisible people around the world that we choose to call terrorists. And many times we simply stir them up and make it worse, as we did in Libya. You know, if we had not invaded Iraq the first time, there'd probably be no war in Syria right now. There'd be no Muslim invasion of Europe and the United States. So these things usually lead bad. I'm inclined to work toward peace whenever that possibility exists. And until it no longer exists, I would be a peaceful person.
There is a common understanding that it is a dangerous thing for those who hate America, openly hate America, openly make threats about what they want to happen to America. If they had the power, they would do it to America. They would annihilate America. There are some who say we can't just wait until these foreign enemies actually advance towards our soil or our airspace to begin attacking us. We have to nip it in the bud and get them before they do so. What is your response to that type of a ideology on military involvement overseas? And also, what is your response to independent sovereign nations that may be a threat, ideologically at least, to the United States and our freedoms and liberties that we cherish, in regard to them owning nuclear weaponry?
Well, the first part I would be very much opposed to. It smacks of Minority Report and pre-crime and that sort of thing. There are people all over the world constantly saying how much they hate us. We see them on television. Otherwise, we don't really know that they hate us. If we didn't let them in, it would be a big help. Admitting tens of thousands of people from countries where they hate you and have sworn your demise is beyond stupid. But the second part of your question is a tougher one. Iran to have nuclear weapons? Well, yes, we obviously do. We made a deal with them where they could obtain them, and we agreed to help them tens of dollars to develop it with. So that kind of seals it. Now North Korea has nuclear weapons, probably even more rogue state than Iran, if that's possible. So should we go attack these countries?
Actually, you read at a very crucial point in your answer. You went dead. Are you there, Daryl?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry.
For some reason, your phone is breaking up now.
You hear me now?
Yeah, in and out. You're still choppy. Are you there, Daryl?
Is that better?
Yes, that's better.
All right. What I was saying is that we obviously want Iran to have nuclear weapons because we made an agreement with them and gave them something like $100 billion. North Korea, I suppose we don't want to have nuclear weapons, but they've got them anyway. So now your problem is that if you want to attack these countries and destroy their ability to produce nuclear weapons, you have to use your own nuclear weapons, which makes you a first use person and basically a pariah in the world. So it's a difficult situation.
No, but you said we wanted Iran to have nuclear weaponry. You're not speaking of you. You're speaking of...
Well, yeah. When I say we, I really mean Washington.
Right, right.
As evidenced by Barack Hussein Obama. Apparently, he and Hillary Clinton were the only two people that really wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
But they got what they wanted, and then they laughed at Congress and admitted they lied to them. But nobody seems to care enough to do anything about it. Which is something I would do if I were elected president, by the way. But nevertheless, I'm not inclined to go around attacking other countries with nuclear weapons unless it becomes an absolute necessity. If I thought the United States was strategically threatened, I would do whatever I had to do to defend my country and my people.
I'd like you to really reiterate to our listeners, especially those that tuned in late and didn't hear some things that were said earlier, what practical value do you believe it is for a citizen of the United States to vote for a candidate such as you, who they agree with ideologically and theologically and morally, but they are voting, even if they, maybe you disagree with this, maybe you believe that God has a position in the White House for you during this election. But if someone were to be certain that you would lose, and yet they agree with most, if not all, of what you stand for, what is the practical reasons they should vote for you anyway, even if they believe it's certain you're going to lose?
Well, I would say that I read a lot in Scripture about being faithful. I don't read anything where it says we are responsible for who gets elected. I mean Christians.
Mm-hmm.
I do read where we are responsible for ourselves, and I read where God tells us what kind of people we should look for in leaders, and I read where he tells us that we should be faithful. So I think we need to trust God. And let, you know, we know, do we believe or not? We need to ask ourselves that question, examine our own beliefs. Are we believers? Do we really trust God that the hearts and minds of nations are in his hands and it's up to him whether Hillary Clinton's elected? Or do we live in constant fear? Because the Bible directs us not to live in fear. Many, many, many places it says, do not be afraid. Do not fear, for I am with you. God rules in nations. He moves them about as he sees fit. If he decides that Daryl Castle should be president, I suppose that means he's not finished with America. But if he decides that Hillary Clinton is president, then she'll be president. And we can just, either way, we can be comforted because it's God's will. I mean, that's the way I see it as a Christian. And from a practical standpoint, if you want something, you're never going to have it if you don't vote for it. Every election cycle, we're told over and over which one of the two evils running is the most evil. So it reminds me of the old Soviet Union where they just told the people, look, these are your candidates. Choose either one you want. You're going to get the same result. So those are all some very good reasons, especially for Christians. You know, Romans... chapter 3 and verse 8 says that you'll be under judgment if you try to do good by doing evil. If you do evil to achieve a good result, you're not to do that. So, once again, I ask you, are you a believer or not?
And now I'd like you to take about 3 minutes to just unburden your heart and leave our listeners with what you most want etched in their hearts and minds right now.
Well, I would say that this country is in danger of losing its constitution. It is in danger of cutting government adrift without any restraints on its power. You asked me a minute ago to address the subject of limited government, and that was frightening to some people. Well, how frightening is unlimited government?
Right.
That's what we have, and it's what we're going to have. In fact, you might say that the Constitution has only 57 days left to live. That is very possible, that we could be living without a rule of law. The rule of law just means that no one is above the law, and no one is beneath the law's protection. In other words, two sets of laws, one for Mrs. Clinton and her ilk, and one for little people like us. That is where we're about to leave ourselves if we don't do something. If we don't come together as people and elect somebody who sees things differently, that is how we're going to end up. So people can have what they want, but they have to vote for.
And in regard one more time to the issue of abortion, do you think that abortion in all circumstances should be illegal? And how would one prosecute the perpetrators of abortion, both the physicians and the women getting them?
Well, I do believe that abortion should be illegal in all circumstances. You know, at this point, I would not be in favor of prosecuting a mother who aborted her baby. I'm not there yet. But I'd be in favor of prosecuting abortionists. Yes, it should be illegal in all circumstances. Killing innocent children should be illegal, yes.
Yes, well, I certainly agree with that, and it is a Holocaust that is absolutely astonishing that it continues in a so-called civilized culture and society in 21st century America, that these babies are being murdered by the millions, and it is absolutely amazing that God has not absolutely unleashed his full wrath on this country already for what we have done. And we who still live here in this country have a lot to be grateful for in regard to his patience and mercy. Well, I know that your personal website is castle2016.com, castle2016.com. And there's also the Constitution Party website, constitutionparty.com, constitutionparty.com. Do you have any other contact information that you care to give?
Yes, I can. People can reach me directly by emailing my campaign manager, and that would be Joan, J-O-A-N, at castle2016.com.
You want to repeat that?
Joan, J-O-A-N, 2016.com.
Okay, great. And if you could one more time repeat that, because you cut out again. I'm sorry.
I said if people want to reach the campaign directly, to volunteer or to ask questions or whatever they want to do, they could email Joan, my campaign manager, Joan, J-O-A-N, at castle2016.com.
All right, thank you so much, Daryl Castle. You know, it has been a real pleasure to have you on the program today. I was very impressed with everything that you said today, in agreement with much of it, and I really pray that the Lord does rise up leaders in this country of your caliber and your vision and your moral principles to govern over us in an earthly sense. And I want to remind our listeners that there is a Bible conference coming up at the Word of Truth Church in Farmingville, Long Island, and that is being held September 23rd and 24th at the Word of Truth Church. For more details, just go to the website of the Word of Truth Church. That's wotchurch.com, wotchurch.com, which stands for Word of Truth Church.com. And we thank you again, Daryl Castle. I look forward to having you back on the program.
Anytime, Chris. I'll be glad to do it.
And I want everybody to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner. We look forward to hearing from you and your questions for our next guests on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. God bless.